Dr. Allison Johnston, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you very much.
So your area of expertise is on the European Union, mm-hmm. and we hear a lot about the current financial crisis and economic situation in mm-hmm. Europe. Anybody who's been to Europe these days knows that they are struggling a mm-hmm. bit, just mm-hmm. like we have been. Can you give us a little background? What is the backstory on this European financial crisis? Kind of when did it start? Why did it start? Because there's some real debate there about kind of the source of the European Union crisis.
Well, I think there's a general consensus that if there can be kind of one catalyst that is blamed for bringing the crisis to light, it's really what happened in the U.S. with the subprime mortgage crisis and the financial crash. But in terms of systematic factors that led to this crisis even before then, I think generally amongst the debate, you have two camps. One is this camp that countries just spent too much fiscally, and kind of your typical poster child of this camp is Greece, that you have high government spending, particularly in boom years when government should be saving. And along comes this crisis, and basically the deficits get much worse and they become unsustainable, and markets become worried about these countries paying them back. And so this is why particularly some countries within the South are having difficulties with the markets on their bonds. Now, there's another camp, basically, which really ties what's going on in Europe prior to the crisis to the relationship that we essentially have with China. And they say it's not necessarily a fiscal problem, because if you look at some countries that are being heavily targeted right now, Ireland, Spain, these countries had very good fiscal balances prior to the crisis, but they're nevertheless being targeted very much by speculators. And they argue that it's a competitiveness problem, that basically the South, including Spain and also including Ireland more recently, have run up these trade deficits with the North, which was very, very competitive, had very restrained wage growth and were very price competitive relative to the South. And in order for the South to buy the North's goods, the North had to lend to the South. And so basically, it was a total borrowing problem, not just a fiscal problem. So in terms of these kind of two camps, you really have the first one. And I think European leaders more prominently identify with the first fiscal camp, that the solution to this is austerity. We have to impose budget cuts, et cetera, on these governments. Whereas with the second camp, I think scholars and policymakers within this camp realize that the problem really is much bigger than the South, that the North, too, also had a bit of a hand in terms of having these balances stem out of control. And they very much benefited from overlending to these countries in the boom years.
So the response, obviously, throughout the European Union has mm-hmm. been varied. I mean, you have mm-hmm. those Germany, for example, right. that has a little stronger mm-hmm. economic position mm-hmm. and is being asked to help kind of carry some others through, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You have countries like Great Britain that mm-hmm. that kind of want to bail out entirely
exactly.
European Union. Mm-hmm. So how is this crisis really affecting the strength of the European Union? Mm-hmm. I mean, we always look at the European Union as kind of that really, you know, strong
right.
institution. We hold it up as an example
yeah.
of the mm-hmm. international organization that can kind of last,
right.
you know, forever. Is that the case, or is this really the kind of crisis that can really bring this institution down?
I think it's a very important crisis for Europe. And I think, you know, particularly for countries like Germany, they really are going through this soul-searching period, because Germany's history, particularly given its history with World War II, has always been with Europe, has always been with the EU. And really prior to even the financial crisis and the fiscal crisis, the EU has really been this trading bloc which has benefited Germany tremendously. And the kind of difficulty now with this crisis is now Germany's actually being asked to make commitments that it hasn't been asked before, namely bailing out countries. Now, admittedly, if you do kind of talk to the average German, I have various German friends, and they're very realistic on the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily Greece we're bailing out. It's our own banks that lent to Greece when they perhaps shouldn't have. But nevertheless, you're having now these kind of cross-border bailouts that the EU never really considered. Indeed, some of the EU treaties, the Maastricht Treaty, designed it so there would not be bailouts. There were no bailout clauses, and basically the leaders of the EU and the Commission have had to kind of work around this. So I think for different countries, you are kind of seeing this soul-searching, particularly in Germany. Britain's always had a very kind of precarious relationship with the EU. They've always seen it just as a trading group, that integration has proceeded a bit faster than they would have liked. And again, I think particularly in Britain, there's a lot of doubt as to how this referendum is going to proceed, that it was relatively a political move for Cameron to get reelected within the next election.
That's the referendum to decide whether they want to stay in or get out of the European Union.
Exactly.
But they never did join the monetary union anyway, right?
Right.
So the impact of all of this, and because you have a very strong institution of which only a few of the members, but most of the members are actually part of the monetary union. But the longer term impact on the euro, I mean, So let's say the European Union maybe weakens some, and you see some select members that, that decide to exit the institution. But what about that euro? Is that likely to survive? Because it's a pretty strong currency around the world, right?
And I think there's a lot of talk about this Grexit. You know, is Greece going to exit the euro? Our country is going to get kicked out of the euro? And whenever I'm asked this question, I like to ask people, well, how likely is it that you think that a state like Massachusetts could kick a state like California out of the dollar because California might be borrowing from the U.S. government? And the problem with this kind of currency union, again, is that while this is always being floated around in the press, the idea of a currency union being broken up, particularly by one country forcing another country out, has not really been legally thought through. And indeed, I think the only case scenario which a country could possibly leave the common currency, the euro, to a huge cost amongst themselves is if they do it unilaterally. And right now, at least support in Greece, even though it's not happy that the euro that the European Commission is imposing a lot of austerity upon them, there's still basically a lot of trust and there's still a lot of support for the euro. They don't want to leave the euro. I think there's kind of concerns as to lessen the terms of these austerity measures. But in terms of the legal breakup of the EU, I think when people kind of discuss this, they don't really realize all the logistics that have to happen and that
the cost that has to happen. It was very expensive to create a monetary union. It's extremely complicated and costly to divide it up.
Exactly. And if you think about it from the creditors' perspective of Greece, they also have a huge interest in Greece not leaving because basically these debts would likely remain in euro denominations. Greece would get their devalued currency back and there would be no way that Greece could repay these high debts. And so they would probably mass default on a much greater scale than if they were left within the currency union. So I think in terms of the currency union breaking up, I think it's in a time of crisis. It's its first crisis. It's a very young currency union. But as to whether it will actually break up, I am very kind of doubtful of the scenario. I think a more common scenario is it might enter a period of kind of prolonged stagnation, much like we saw in Japan in the 1990s. But I doubt a breakup is on the cards anytime soon.
So you mentioned austerity, and that relates, I think, in some way at least, to another area that you focus on, and that is the issue of strikes in the European Union, and in particular countries where, I mean, who hasn't traveled to Europe and not experienced some sort of, you know, transportation strike, for example, where buses shut down, taxis shut down, the pilots go on strike, something, you know, to affect, you know, the mobilization of people and things and goods. So what is it about strikes that seem to be so much more prevalent in Europe? Obviously, unions play a role. But also, could you tell us a little bit about why we see in some places kind of violent response to some of these austerity measures and in other places strikes or kind of minimal violence or no violence related to these kinds of measures?
Well, I think in terms of austerity strikes, we see particularly a lot of them in the countries that are most affected by the crisis for good reason, because this is where austerity is most acute. These are where the measures, kind of austerity measures that are being enforced with kind of the greatest pain. So it's really been kind of an effective way for unions to kind of go out and mobilize mass opposition to policies, which not only hurt their own members, but hurt the public at large. As for other countries, you do see kind of dissatisfaction with austerity policy. The UK is a really good example, but you don't necessarily see general strikes. In some cases, it's because they're calling general strikes. There are a lot of legal provisions against the capacity to do so. So in the UK, in Germany, for example, it's actually illegal for unions to call general strikes. And if they want to call strikes, they have to go through various conditions and implement various procedures in order to call strikes against employers. So in that sense, I think really the divergence that we see, a lot of it has to do with country context, but also the institutional constraints that are upon unions in calling these strikes.
So the response in Greece mm-hmm. versus the response in the yeah. UK, mm-hmm. I mean, there's this considerable yeah. difference. And that's kind of local context, local culture. Yeah. There's some explanation that yeah. would suggest that really all these European countries really aren't all the same.
Right, exactly. And particularly with Greece, I mean, Greece from a general strike perspective is a huge outlier. I mean, in terms of our data, we look at general strikes within Europe from 1980 to 2009, and Greece accounts for about a third of them. They strike quite frequently. And I think as a result of such frequent strike activity, their governments are very unlikely to give concessions to unions. They don't cater to unions' requests or demands during general strikes. But you do see general strikes in countries like the Netherlands, as well as Finland, where they happen a little bit less frequently. But when trade unions do call them, or when they threaten to call them, governments do stand up and take notice. And oftentimes it's very common, particularly within northern European countries, for governments to try and include unions at the table in terms of policymaking to alleviate kind of that political pressure that may be associated with very unpopular welfare reforms and labor market reforms.
So labor then is well integrated into mm-hmm. the activities of the European Union. They work together.
Yeah.
And so do these activities, these strikes, the you know, labor stoppage or whatever, mm-hmm. this stuff, does it have an impact on the European Union? What is the outcome here, I guess? Are we
yeah.
seeing that those kinds of strikes are really, you know, having a positive or a negative
right.
impact on the overall mm-hmm. European situation?
So again, we really look at it from kind of these national contexts. And in terms of outcomes, we see that with austerity strikes, it's very unlikely that unions will receive outcomes of any sort from governments. And basically, kind of the reason why is because if you're imposing an austerity measure, generally the situation has gotten so bad where the government has very little maneuvering room to act in order to give concessions to unions. But we have seen that in the 90s, 2000s, that unions have been effective at securing some concessions from government in terms of pension reforms, welfare reform, labor market reform, etc. And we see that they're particularly effective from securing these from kind of more center governments, also when union confederations, when they're all united in a strike call, they're very effective at securing concessions from coalition governments. So really kind of governments that rely upon this consensus and where unions are really ingrained in policymaking, namely in northern European countries, where you have this kind of history where unions, employers, and government all work together on policy issues. You do see that unions still have this influence, even though organizationally they have witnessed kind of a decline in union numbers quite significantly over time.
Well, you mentioned the pensions. System. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is a major issue from across Europe. I mean, here
right.
you have a general demographic where mm-hmm. you have a population that's growing old.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you have fewer people in the workforce. You have these massive pension programs mm-hmm. that are mm-hmm. way underfunded. I mean,
yep.
it makes our social security system perhaps
right.
look mm-hmm. like it's in a good place. So how are they going to fix that? I mean, mm-hmm. as if, you know, we
right.
should have the answers
yeah.
to our own
yeah.
our own social security system, but
mm-hmm.
but that is something that is particularly troubling, right? And
right.
and labor and all of these particular interest groups, and then of course these movements, these mm-hmm. strikes and the austerity measures. I mean, all of that stuff is very much related to
mm-hmm.
what they're going to do with these social programs, the
mm-hmm.
social net.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think especially with pensions, you know, the real cause for concern with pensions is it's not necessarily a financing problem; it's an output problem. That, you know, we have the baby boom generation retiring soon, the labor force that is currently in place compared to the number of pensioners that are going to be retiring is going to be significantly reduced. And so there is concern as is there just going to be enough output to go around to service both pensioners and people that are working within the labor force. Now, various countries have gone about different policies in terms of trying to address these issues. A popular one is kind of changing contributions, increasing contributions, or reducing pension payouts. A second one is raising the retirement age. This is something that's very much been advocated and implemented by various European governments.
But quite controversial as
very
well,
controversial,
right?
Exactly. And we see that here again, unions are in some countries having a lot of influence in terms of how these reforms are being made. particularly also within Europe and within the U.S., there might be a kind of a similar context. But especially within countries like Italy and France in the 1990s, you see unions also very involved, surprisingly, willing to come to the table to discuss reform of public pensions, which tend to be more generous than private sector pensions. So in this sense, I think generally within the United States, we kind of see unions as these ardent defenders of generous pensions and generous wages. But at least within Europe, and we see within certain contexts, unions are willing to kind of sit down and negotiate and make concessions in terms of reducing the generosity of these pensions, as long as it might result in kind of greater protection of part-time workers or atypical workers, et cetera.
Well, it seems like they may not have much choice but to negotiate on these issues,
absolutely.
given their situation. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Johnston, thank you so much for joining us today on Worldviews to discuss a very interesting topic.
Thank you.
Thanks.